Hey everybody, welcome to Flaherty's on Films.
Spooky Flaherty's on Films.
Really scary. You're gonna be scared. This week we're talking about Friday the 13th, and hit the music.
Friday the 13th.
Hello everybody, I'm Michael Flaherty.
And I'm Colleen Flaherty.
This is a podcast about movies. We're going down the best movies of all time, obviously.
In our new and improved AFI list.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, what are we talking about this week?
This week, oh boy, what a treat. We are talking about the movie Friday the 13th,
Whoa.
Which is a 1980s movie. I'll read the little description here. A group of camp counselors are stalked and murdered by...
Spoilers, IMDb.
Jesus Christ. By an unknown assailant while trying to reopen a summer camp, which, years before, was the site of a child's drowning.
Yep. Michael, what'd you think of the film?
I have seen the film before.
I think you suggested this film.
I did suggest it. We, just for our listeners, you can suggest us films, and we will do your films. This week, we're doing my film. And I think maybe last week was also my film, because that was The Matrix.
And by the way, we're doing these in random order, but this we're doing special because it's Halloween.
Today is Halloween. Get your candy. What's your favorite candy, Colleen?
Kit Kat.
Snickers is the best, so.
I don't like peanuts.
That's fair. what are my impressions of the film? It's a really dumb movie. I think this is important. I don't think either of us very much like horror films at all.
Not too much.
Which I don't know why. Right? Like, I've always said that I don't like horror because, like, I don't want to be scared.
I don't like to be scared.
But why wouldn't I say that about any other high emotional state that media gives you, right? Like, other media makes you tense, but I like that.
Tense doesn't, like, keep me up at night wondering what's in the shadows.
Right, but I mean, as a person who has anxiety problems, I feel like the last thing I need is tense, you know?
I guess.
I'm just tense in the day, you know, just sitting down.
I don't know what to tell you.
Thanks.
Don't like being scared.
That's fair. And I don't either. But this movie is not that scary.
No.
It's really kind of dorky.
I do think it's actually pretty... it's not a bad pick for the AFI because you kind of see it... Like, so I've watching this for the first time. It is completely cliche now, that movie. But it's the first one, right? I mean, Halloween's probably the first one. But this is one of the first schlocky horror movies.
I mean, Jason is an icon.
Where they're hunting down sexy teens and like, and it's silly. And, it, you know, it's very much of a kind. And this started it. So
does that surmise your whole first impressions of the viewing?
I mean, my first impression was it's pretty silly. And it was exciting to see Kevin Bacon.
It was exciting to see Kevin Bacon. That was a great segment. But now we're going to go to our first real segment, which is BAM.
Time for Sam.
Where she's going to tell some cool facts about the film.
Sam, take it away.
Okay, so actually, I found this interesting. This movie is a first in a category that you might not be expecting that I think really proves that it should have been on the AFI list.
Whoa.
But we'll get to that. So inspired by the success of the first slasher film Halloween, producer and director Sean Cunningham worked with screenwriter Victor Miller to tell a story about a group of camp counselors who are being haunted by an unknown killer. Also, there's going to be a lot of spoiler alerts in this fact.
I feel like Halloween is that exactly. You ever seen that film?
I haven't actually seen it.
It's that exactly. People are...
So Friday the 13th is a ripoff.
Well,
the idea that I read was he wanted to do it differently. Like, he saw it as a... This is bad. He saw it as a cheap way to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yep. But he also wanted to make it differently. So he wanted it to be more of like a roller coaster of emotions.
Ooh,
and
that's... Yes. Yes.
So that's just what he saw.
All right.
Although the script was originally titled A Long Night at Camp Blood, Cunningham would decide to change it to Friday the 13th. Before the screenplay was finished, Cunningham would take out an ad in Variety, advertising the film under its new title. He hired a New York advertising agency to come up with the iconic logo of the title breaking through a glass screen. And he got a lot of positive reviews of people being like, yeah, I want to see that movie. When's it coming out? And no screen, like it was not done yet.
So we can imagine John Draper making that logo.
Ooh.
I won't lie. That's 100% what I thought of when I read that. I'm like,
it's about shared experiences. You know, it's really about family. It's about yearning for the lost idea of nostalgia. That's his pitch.
That's the way he would do it.
Eventually, but imagine it's like sexy John Hamm saying that.
He's drinking and smoking too. It's good.
Eventually, the script was completed and casting would begin. Cunningham is quoted as saying he was looking for good-looking kids who you might see in a Pepsi commercial. He was not looking for great actors. This is all things he's said. But actors who...
Too bad that Kevin Bacon came on.
But good-looking kids who could read the dialogue and, more importantly, work for cheap. Although what we think of as stars, the biggest names in the film is undoubtedly Kevin Bacon. But before this film, he had only done a few small roles.
He was in Animal House, right?
Yeah, but it was a very small role.
Okay.
The actual biggest name at the time was Harry Crosby, who played Bill. He was the son of the recently deceased Bing Crosby.
Who is this character in the film?
Oh my God. When I was, or when someone was writing the summary and I wrote down all the names, I'm like, who is anybody? Like, I have no idea who anybody's name was.
I'm pretty sure Kevin Bacon is Jack.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah. I don't know who Bill is though, but he's played by Bing Crosby.
So it is Jack Burl.
Yeah. He has a last name.
Apparently.
So the casting team also wanted a wholesome older soap opera star to play Mrs. Voorhees. The reason behind this was to give it a little star power to the film, to delay the realization that she's the killer because it's a wholesome actor. And sadly, because if they could get an older soap opera star, they could probably get her for cheap.
Sure, sure.
Yep. They approached several women before finally getting a yes from Betsy Palmer. She would originally hate the story, but it would eventually come to not only embrace her character, but come up with an intricate backstory, including the psychology of why her character became a murderer.
Got it.
Nice.
Cool. It was really intense. Like, was this good girl in school but got knocked up? That's why she hates sex, because sex leads to bad stuff.
She's my favorite.
It was like this whole, I was reading a little bit of it. I'm like, you spent way too much time on this. The movie was filmed at Camp Nobi Bosco.
Whoa. What is that?
It's probably a Native real American camp in New Jersey. It's literally N-O-B-E-B-O.
Oh.
Well, it must be New Jersey because it connects to the ocean.
Right, exactly.
That's a little Jason 6 joke?
This Jason.
Jason 7.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Sam and Michael have watched 11 Jason films?
Yes, we have. Yes. The cast and crew moved in after the campers left for the summer in 1979.
That was Jason Takes Manhattan. I feel like you need all the information. Go on.
They kind of got that from the context.
The camp is still in operation today and has a wall of Friday the 13th paraphernalia.
That's spooky.
Most of the cast and crew stayed in local hotels, but a few stayed at the actual campsite. A few of the devoted included makeup artist Tom Savini, who only had a few movies he brought with him to entertain him at night. So to this day, he can recite the movies Barabella and Marathon Man by heart.
Oh. Interesting. This is such a good premise. Like, campsites are spooky.
Nah,
oh, yeah. Definitely.
Have you guys ever been to a sleepaway camp? They're spooky.
A sleepaway camp.
Yeah, like a camp where you sleep.
Isn't that all camps?
No, sometimes there's day camps.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, sleepaway camps are terrifying.
I've been to one. I just didn't know it had the word.
You
sleepaway.
Went to the church one, right? Camp. I went to Girl Scout one because I'm cool.
That's very cool. I wish I would have done that.
I went to a dance camp.
That's the coolest.
Thank you. So speaking of Tom Savini, he is a legendary makeup effects specialist who is known for his blood and gore effects. This movie helped showcase his work. So he had done...
This was a showcase of his expert blood and guts work?
So he had done three...
Pinnacle, I believe is the word.
I think he had done like two movies before, maybe three, and like... Each film was like, this one, he really perfected biting. But this one was just like, yeah, he's really good at the blood and gore.
Okay.
He got. As he was staying at the camps during filming, many of the latex applications used for the special effects were actually baked in the camp's pizza ovens.
Gross.
One of the most impressive stunts and the most difficult to accomplish was
the
death. I
have no idea what you're going to say.
Of Kevin Bacon.
Oh, sure.
quick description for those who haven't seen the film. Bacon is lying on his back on his bed.
And he's like, yeah, I'm a stud.
Yeah, he just had sex.
Warning about what's going to happen. I'm warning the audience.
And then suddenly a hand comes out from under the bed and holds his head down, and an arrow is stabbed through the mattress and all the way through his neck. It's pretty awesome.
It's very silly looking.
It's like It's like if his body were made out of Ken doll parts, but there is his face, which is completely different skin tone to said neck that he is getting stabbed through.
Don't even care. I loved it.
He's kind of a Ken doll normally.
Okay, so to accomplish this, they needed a couple of people to help. And so your question of the week, how many people were underneath that bed?
That's a great question.
To accomplish this.
Okay, I have my answer.
Okay, I didn't write it down, but I'll write it down.
Five.
Okay, I haven't written it down yet, but I was going to write down four.
It is four.
Five is too many!
Obviously, it's too many. That's why it would be an interesting fact!
I'm sorry, four is still too many.
What is it called when you do that to the mic?
Clipping?
Clipping.
Well, because consider, like, this is what, maybe, I think it's a twin bed.
Yeah.
Very small.
And they were all underneath it. So let me
explain. Assuming they aren't all 100% under the bed.
They were.
They were tiny people.
So let me explain how this happened. So
I can't wait.
Bacon was forced to sit under the bed. So he's like kind of squatting because underneath
the bed. You
mean
it wasn't his real body?
And then he would stick his head through a hole, but then he'd have to angle it back. So it was like lying down. So picture that.
All of us are angling our head back just to see if we could do it.
Go on, Sam.
Then Salvino was also under the bed and he had to be right up by Kevin so he could plunge the arrow up. Mm-hmm. And then his assistant was under the bed right next to him because he had the pump and the hose to spray the fake blood. And then another crew was on the other side of the bed so that he could be the hand to hold them down.
Okay.
So it took hours to get everyone and everything into place. So they're all sitting there for hours.
It's a bonding for sure.
Imagine Kevin. God, that must have been terrible. Then while filming, they did it all in one take. The hose for the blood pump disconnected. So the assistant thought quickly and just blew into the hose until the blood flowed, thus saving the scene. He would later say, I had to think quick. So I just grabbed the hose and blew like crazy, which thankfully caused a serendipitous arterial. What's that word?
Arterial?
Sure. Blood spray. The blood didn't taste that bad either.
Ugh.
Well, it's just like corn syrup,
sure,
right?
Sure. It's just water, but.
So that was one of the cool stunts there.
That was a good stunt.
Yeah. Now, as we've already discussed, Michael and I have seen all the Jason films. And one of our favorite things about the films is the Jason song.
That's
goes
a
like that.
Song?
It's a musical. So, it's a motif.
I didn't really get, was Jason making the noise?
Yeah, he's literally walking around camp going.
Do you say that? Like Star Wars, like so are there violins around?
No, but I know Darth Vader's making that noise. And well, that's an ominous noise, as like well as the one he is making.
Music and noise intersect.
All right. You know, thank you for explaining film to me.
So anyways, unlike Halloween, which used a lot of music, the film's composer decided to make his music more like Jaws, where the song is only played when the enemy is close.
Love it. Love it.
It's so similar to Jaws.
So like at the beginning of the film, when Jason's or Mrs. Voorhees isn't around, you don't really hear a lot of music. But then towards the end, it's almost nonstop, like a wall of music. After watching the film, he was looking for a distinctive sound to really represent the killer. And he found it when he saw Mrs. Voorhees imitating Jason by saying, "Killer, mommy." So, as he put it, I got the idea of taking the k from kill and the m from mommy, but spoke them very harshly, distinctly, and rhythmically into a microphone and then ran them through the 70s echo thing. This guy's very sophisticated. And it came up as you hear it today. So every time there was the perspective of the stalker, I put that into the score.
I didn't know it was a ma. I thought it was a ka.
Yeah, I thought it was ka too.
Okay, so we've always done ka when we imitate it. Not that we do that all the time, but
we
you
do
know,
it a lot.
Yeah, we do it a lot. But apparently, like one of my facts I was reading was he gets really offended when people think it's cha, like cha cha. And he's like, why do people hear that? There's no cha cha.
That's awesome.
It's cute.
So in the original skip, Jason Voorhees is just a kid who accidentally drowned. However, a financier of the film wanted a little bit more, so he requested a rewrite.
VIP, this financier.
The idea to have Jason suddenly appear was actually Tom Savini's, the makeup artist. According to him, the whole reason for the cliffhanger at the end was that I had just seen Carrie, so we thought we needed a chair jumper like that, and I said, let's bring in Jason. The original screenwriter, Victor Miller, hated the change. To quote, "To be honest, I've never seen any of the sequels, but I have a major problem with all of them because they make Jason the villain. I still believe that the best part of my screenplay was the fact that a mother figure was the serial killer, working from a horribly twisted desire to avenge the senseless death of her son, Jason. Jason was dead from the beginning. He was a victim, not a villain. And I took motherhood and turned it on its head, and I think it was great fun." Mrs. Voorhees, I want to get this quote out, Colleen, because it's so weird. "Mrs. Voorhees was the mother I've always wanted."
What the fuck?
"A mother who would have killed for her kids."
What the hell?
So I don't mean to be an asshole about this, but is this guy really being that precious about the script? I mean, he's obviously a more successful screenplay writer than any of us here, but really?
And then scene two, she gets coffee.
That's a rough, she looks out the window and nothing happens. Cut two.
We'll talk about this all later.
So after the movie was made, they went to the studios to get... So it was made by an independent company. And then they went to the studios to get it distributed, the distribution rights. There was an actual bidding war over the rights. As someone said...
Well, because Halloween was really successful, right?
Right. So as one of the producer or executive said, the minute we saw Friday the 13th, we knew it would be a hit. And basically what they were saying is it's a horror film, which Halloween was really successful. It was really low budget. Like, I think it was $500,000 total. Wow. Like, it was just super. And on top of it, the studio deemed it low risk. So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
This became...
I don't know. It's got a boob in it.
This became the first independent film to be acquired by a major motion picture studio.
Damn. That's kind
really?
Of cool.
That is a really cool fact.
There you go. That's why I think it deserves to be on the list. Anyway, it's was a huge hit. It has was a box office sensation. It was the third highest Paramount, I think, had it. And it was the third highest Paramount movie of the year, only beat out by Airplane.
Nice. Good job, Airplane.
And one Cowboy something. One other one. I don't remember.
Midnight Cowboy?
No, it was a Midnight Cowboy.
That was in the 70s.
Yeah, it was a different cowboy one. Urban Cowboy. That's it. So it was just, it was a huge sensation. And right
Michael,
away.
Great pick.
Thank you.
Right away, they just continued to do sequels. Like the next sequel was a year later. And it has come out with 10 sequels, one crossover, and then a reboot. Making it at 12 films with Jason, meaning there has to be a 13th.
It's crazy.
It's insane.
We also watched Jason X the night we watched Friday the 13th. And that's the 10th film where he goes to space.
That's a very
and
good
And what'd
film.
You think of it, Colleen?
It was something. It was quite a backstory. A lot of world building for the future, but also in space.
That's a 10 of it. Here's Welcome to Flareon Films, a mini podcast within the podcast where we talk about Jason X. That is, that's the longest 90 minutes that you could spend in your life, but it's so good.
I mean, it's so much before we even get to Jason because we need to explain why we're all here.
It's
there's Earth 1
up.
And Earth 2.
We
and
have to explain the pincers.
Right. So much.
Holodeck.
And they even have to explain why they're all young and hot because they're actually students. It's a student vessel. It's something. And then he, oh my God, right, because we learn why he's immortal, and then he has to reanimate himself, but he doesn't have enough body parts, so some of it's machine.
That explains the new cool mask. What do you grade Jason X?
A+.
A+.
Okay, Sam,
continue. That was Flurry of Films, the mini podcast within a podcast.
Well, what would you rate it?
A+. Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Fair enough. No, those are all of my facts, but I will just put out some personal opinions. If you do decide to dive into the Jason world, I personally love number 3, number 6, and I think number 10.
Do they call it the Fridayverse? The Jasonverse?
Yeah, the Jasonverse.
My favorite fact you guys told me was about Jason Takes Manhattan, and they like had all these plans, but they couldn't afford it, so he's on a cruise ship the whole time.
Yeah, so most of the films, I won't say all because it's just most, take place around Crystal Lake. And then at one point they wanted to get into Manhattan, so they just have this giant cruise ship where all the students are on that somehow connects to the Atlantic Ocean and takes them to Manhattan.
In fairness, I think there's like a guy is like on his yacht that goes and sails to a cruise ship that goes to the Atlantic. I don't think the cruise ship is
there. The cruise ship is there, dude.
No, it's not. I don't think the cruise ship itself is in Crystal Lake. I think the opening is a guy in a yacht. Like, he has a fancy boat.
I mean, there's still a guy in a yacht going to Crystal Lake from the Atlantic Ocean.
It's a little bit less silly than an entire cruise ship in the lake.
But the third movie is 3D, and they have all the fun 3D effects, like a guy yo-yoing at you. That's fun.
Sam, that was so great. That was...
Bam!
Time for Sam. This next segment is something we like to call Critics Corner. See what they think about the film.
This will be a great, because people could very much have legitimate criticism.
Perhaps. For all its shoddiness, the film manages just barely to achieve its ignoble goals. It delivers what it promises, says David Kerr of the Chicago Reader, which sure, yeah.
Laugh because I read ahead. The movie is too bad, so sad, no scary parts. Do not purchase, rent, waste time, / money. To all the old people that think this movie is scary, it is not. It is so bad. A lot of D's there. Thumbs down emoji. Thank you for your time. I want my $4 back. Big S likes scary movies.
Is his name.
That's his name. Just all caps that.
He's an Amazon reviewer. Actually, the Amazon reviews are a bit tricky because Amazon has sometimes has products of the same name.
Yeah.
So most of the one-star reviews were remake. Of the remake and just dunking on Michael Bay, which was crazy. See,
is it a Michael Bay film?
Yeah.
Oh, actually. Oh,
I think he produced it or something. And it was, I just couldn't believe how many big Friday the 13th fans there were that they're like, this is nothing like the original. Anyway, a tame, poorly plotted serving of schlock. Less horrific for its ketchup-smeared murders than for the barefaced fashion in which it tries and fails to rip off Carpenter's Halloween in matters of style and construction.
Whoa,
said
harsh
Time Out's top critic.
That's probably our first harsh top critic review.
Probably.
Historic moment. All right, here's by Goon Moon. Love it. Most of the death takes place off camera. It seems that the budget only extended to two major on-camera shots. But the single biggest structural problem with the film, can't wait for this, is that all of the deaths take place in secret. So up to halfway through the final reel, none of the teens at Camp Crystal Lake actually realize that they're in danger. Dude, I'm sorry to interrupt this, but listen to Hitchcock, okay? So it's tense because they don't know what we know.
I thought you didn't like that. I thought you said that was shit.
While some of them are getting bumped off in distant buildings, the bulk of them are happily playing Monopoly.
Which we will get to. Yeah, put a pin in that.
It's not regular Monopoly. This means that we never get to experience any fear vicariously through any of the characters because, well, none of them are experiencing any. And the confrontation between the killer and the final girl is hilariously awful. Is this a bad review? She has three clear opportunities to end the killer's life and doesn't take any of them. By the end, I was yelling for the killer to succeed.
Wow.
That's by Goon Moon.
The whole film is one of the best arguments for resuming movie censorship to come along in years, says Joseph Litch of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Joe, what? Come on. Here we go. This is by Raven. And Raven says, trash. A few good scenes still focusing on cheap, slobbery sex scenes no one gives a hoot about.
Wow.
Colleen, do you think the sex scenes were slobbery?
I mean, they were long.
Were they long?
Well, they were long in comparison to the film because it's very short.
Yeah.
And they do focus on it. I don't know.
Yeah.
They weren't sexy. They were happening.
They were just sort of there.
Anyway, that was Critics Corner.
Great segment.
Well, here's our next segment, Mike. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
This is the part where we talk about what we liked most and least about the film in a little segment we call Favorite, Least Favorite Part.
I think you want to talk about your least favorite part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, people at home, I'm sure most of you have played the game Monopoly.
Yeah.
It's a long game.
Yeah.
It's complicated. Every turn.
A lot of rules.
A lot of rules. A lot of acquiring of property.
A lot of resource management.
A lot of resource. Thank you, Michael. Yeah. Lot of resource management.
Yeah.
Now, somebody at home needs to explain to me how you could possibly play Strip Monopoly. All right. Generously, if you're like a shoes and socks hair accessories person, you have 10 items of clothing, which you never really would. But let's say you're over in three turns. In this fucking film where they play Strip Monopoly, there's a cut to where someone has lost most of their clothes, but not all of them. And there's hotels on the board. You get hotels in hour four of playing Monopoly. What the hell? Is this the most boring, sexy game ever? One. What? B. Yes, I said one and B. What could the rules be? How are you trading on these clothes?
My favorite part of watching this is that we have a relative, I'm not going to name names, but he's tall and beautiful. He came in halfway through the film and you are just ranting about strip Monopoly. He goes, oh yeah, I've played that. We're just like, what?
And he did not explain it. So, I don't believe him.
Protecting his identity there.
Oh, my other favorite thing, though, about watching it, we were watching it with our friend Jim, who just kept getting incredulously mad at normal things in the film. Like, yeah. Why are there so many sinks in that bathroom? Because it's a camp bathroom that many people need to use at once.
That's actually a realistic thing about it.
Anyway, what's your least favorite part?
I feel like we have not given this movie enough context yet, because it's not very good, but it is very fun to watch with other people. And this is going to lead into my favorite parts. I'm trying to think of what my least favorite
part actually is. Really agree with one of those reviewers who was like, it delivers exactly on what you'd expect, which I think.
What is my least favorite part? I don't know. I mean, the movie is so simple and straightforward.
I think it could have been shorter.
Oh, I mean, I wonder if there's a rule of how long you have to be. Because I felt like they all... I mean, I've seen them all.
And I feel they're like all 90 minutes?
They all go over right over the 90 minutes. Some with a lot of flashbacks. I mean, I feel like they have to try and justify their runtime.
Right. This movie could have been 50 minutes easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually thought it would do more jump scares. And maybe it tried to, but it didn't get me one time.
It could have been... Okay, so that's my least favorite part. Could have been sillier. Like, I loved the silliness, but it's like, why not more?
Yeah.
What's your favorite part?
Well, my favorite part is how schlocky it is, how silly it is.
Yeah.
That's kind of enjoyable. That's it.
I'll tell you my favorite part. I watched this movie like the first time like a year ago, and I knew what it was, but I really didn't understand it. And like halfway through the film, I just came to this realization like, oh, this is it. It's just like a film where five people die, and that's it.
Spoiler.
It's like so simple, and I feel like it is better than Halloween, which is a very similar film, because it's more like a game where like they all like you there's five people they establish, here are our players, right?
And we don't know their names or personalities,
and we'll never will.
We're like trying to figure out who's the slut. It's like doesn't matter.
Does not matter. And you just know for every single film spoiler, four of them will die, one of them will win. And you even kind of know ahead of time who the winner is going to be. You know very
early. I guessed the first person to die was the woman who actually lasted the whole time.
So that was a mistake. But they're just like so simple.
Yeah.
There's like so nothing to it.
That actually leads to our intern summary, because just a little note, if you have not seen the film, now you don't need to this summary, because it's going to go into every nook and cranny of what happens.
Which is, I'm surprising there are any nooks and crannies, because this is, it's very light on content. So it's just super fun to watch with people.
Oh, except the intern summary does not have the real scene where she's like kind of nervous and makes instant coffee. We see her fill up the water. We see her go to the pantry to get the canister. We see her scoop the instant coffee into a cup, and then nothing happens. That's a real scene.
Wasn't Jim mad at like, why'd she have all that much sugar?
And we're like, she's not gonna put the whole thing of sugar.
She's just taking the can of sugar to the thing.
Why would you take a scoop?
She's not gonna scoop from the pantry over to the gym.
Anyway, Michael, you want to start us off with this intern summary?
So we start the film with a flashback. It's 1958, and the place is Camp Crystal Lake. Two perky blonde counselors are singing Kumbaya in a creepy manner, which apparently gets them going. They sneak away to get busy, but unfortunately they get murdered by an unseen assailant. 21 years later, camp counselor Annie Phillips, I never would have thought of that name if you had quizzed me. I've seen the movie twice. Is given a lift halfway to the reopened Camp Crystal Lake by a truck driver. Despite Crazy Ralph. Crazy old Murray.
You're doomed. That's my impression of Crazy Ralph.
That's pretty good. Despite Crazy Ralph warning her about the doom while driving. Enos? What's this?
Enos.
What's that?
That's the truck driver. There was a period that you did not recognize in when you were speaking.
While driving.
Warning her about her doom. While driving, Enos warns Annie.
Enos warns Annie about the camp's past, informing her about the young boy who drowned across the lake in 1957 and the two murderers. After being dropped off, she hitches another ride from an unseen person who chases her into the woods and slashes her throat.
Oh no. At the camp, counselors Ned Rubenstein, Jack Burrell, Kevin Bacon, Bill Brown, Macy Cunningham, Brenda Jones. I don't know why I put the last name.
These are so many names.
And Alice Hardy.
Who are any of these people?
Well, Alice Hardy is the Dorothy Hamill here, who I thought was going to die right away.
I don't know who Dorothy Hamill is. We said that a lot during our viewing.
She's an ice skater who has a kind of a mushroom haircut.
Don't they all have that? I mean, they got to have short hair.
I don't know. Oh, ice skaters? Yeah. No, they have long hair sometimes. They pull it back.
What, isn't that bad for aerodynamics?
I don't know. I remember, she's got it. Sam's.
Oh, nice. We're getting a visual. Sorry, listeners.
Just Google it, guys. You have the technology. Along with the owner, Steve Christie, refurbished the cabins and facility. Yeah, okay. So I thought they were kind of going to go into like, oh, I think the owner was maybe sleeping with someone. No. We don't know any of these people's motivations, except one of them is kind of the silly nerd, but even that.
Yeah. There's no character development. There's no plot.
The day goes by and Steve leaves town to stock up on supplies, the counselors play as various odd things happen. Alice finds a snake in her cabin, which is killed with a machete, which, by the way, this camp has a ton of weapons lying around. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Why do they just... maybe a machete is a useful tool. All the counselors go swimming in the lake for some relaxation, and Ned ruins it by pretending to drown.
That's a very good prank.
That's so funny. They get a visit from Officer Dorf, who arrives...
These names are great.
If only we knew them. Who arrives to search for Crazy Ralph, hassles the counselors and warns the group to stay out of trouble. Frankly, he was just doing his job and everyone was giving him a hard time.
Uh-oh. Okay, here's where it gets really bad. As the thunderstorm approaches, Steve leaves the campground to stock supplies. Ned sees someone walk into the cabin and follows, while Jack and Marcy have sex in one of the cabin's bunk beds. One of these, Jack here is Kevin Bacon.
They are unaware of Ned's body above them with his throat slit. Oh, no!
Oh, no! When Marcy leaves to use the bathroom, Jack's throat is pierced with an arrow from beneath the bed.
Which we talked about.
The killer falls.
It was his face when he dies is like, I know you guys can't see me, but you can imagine exactly what that
face
is.
Imagine what it sounds like. The killer follows Marcy into the bathrooms and slams the axe into her face, which I think she's a very funny death as well.
Well, yeah, because she turns around and doesn't move at all. She's like, ah! And then it's one of those cuts where, like, obviously you don't see the axe going. It's just an axe to the face.
Yeah.
No.
Later, Steve returns and recognizes the unseen killer who stabs him.
It was so great. He's like, hey there. Hey, what are you doing out here? Whoa, what's that?
It's very fun.
In Alice's cabin, Brenda, Bill, and Alice decide to play Strip Monopoly to pass the time, which... would take no time at all and too much time. I don't understand it.
Also, they just get bored halfway through, which is like...
Yeah. Well, I do... Yeah. Down to her underwear, Brenda decides to call it a night. And it was like her idea, but I think she was losing.
And she's like, all right, that was fun.
It's like, what was even the point of that?
I don't think you got
especially because you got to hotel level. That is some serious Monopoly play. That means somebody also, had a Monopoly.
And they had money distributed, so I'm not sure. I feel like
they what's even the point of the clothes thing? Maybe it's
money and clothes.
Ugh.
Worried by their friend's disappearances, Alice and Bill... Okay, so who's the main character?
Alice.
Okay. Alice and Bill leave the main cabin to investigate. They find the axe in Brenda's bed, the phone's disconnected, the car's inoperable.
Can I say, none of the characters are reacting correctly to this, and maybe it's because horror movies didn't exist back then, but they're like, oh my god, there's a bloody axe in here. Oh god. Oh. What are we going to do? I don't know, man.
Yeah.
They're just not appropriately terrified.
I think I'm here. When the power goes out, Bill's goes to check on the generator. Alice heads out to look for him and finds his body pinned with arrows to the generator room's door. She flees to the main cabin to hide, only to be traumatized further when Brenda's body is thrown through the window.
Oh, no.
Soon after, Alice sees a vehicle pull up and rushes outside, thinking it's Steve. Instead, she is greeted by a middle-aged woman named Mrs. Voorhees, who could that be, who claims to be an old friend of Steve's.
Oh, no. Mrs. Voorhees starts criticizing Steve for trying to open the camp after all that had happened here.
calling the camp cursed. Mrs. Voorhees tells Alice that her son Jason died at the camp in 1957. Mrs. Voorhees goes on a tangent describing how she was the camp's cook. Now Jason, who just wasn't a good swimmer, had drowned in the lake when the counselors left the children unsupervised to go off and have sex. After telling Alice that June 13th, a Friday, is her son's birthday, which, again, I can understand why this guy was really protective of his art.
Right. He was born specifically on all Fridays of every year of 13.
She switches between talking to herself and shouting at Alice, accusing her personally of killing her son. Mrs. Voorhees pulls out a hunting knife, the same one used to kill several of Alice's friends.
Hey, you know what? She was a good actress.
Yeah, I actually thought she was pretty good.
She was actually very, very good in the film. Mrs. Voorhees heads back to the generator room to turn off the power back on before continuing the chase. She corners Alge in the storage shed where Alge fires a shotgun.
Because there is a wall of shotguns at this camp.
They're like BB guns. They're not shotguns.
It says shotgun. I don't know. I mean, I do believe that it was a thing in olden day camps that they would do like shooting ranges. Probably,
yeah, but
with
not
kids.
Not with shotguns. Maybe. They were just like little pellet guns. I don't know. But the ammunition drawer is chained and locked. Before Alice can load it, Mrs. Voorhees attacks her and slaps her around.
So I know what that Amazon reviewer was getting at. It was like she was clearly acting as a middle-aged woman, just kind of slapping this healthy teenage girl who could have easily fought back.
It's fair to say there's no threat at this part of the story.
The tension is like, is she going to slap her to death? Like... okay, Alice.
Alice escapes and runs back to the main cabin, hiding behind a locked door in the pantry. Mrs. Voorhees breaks open the door and rushes in at Alice, brandishing a machete.
See, now there's a threat. Now she has a weapon. Also, when she was in the pantry, she kept leaning up against the door, and you and Sam were like, don't do that, because you never lean up against a door or window, because that's where they get you.
Jason loves doing that.
Windows especially, though.
Windows more so. Alice hits her on the side of the head with a frying pan, knock her out. Alice sits by the lakeside, hoping that it is all over, but Mrs. Voorhees... you really gotta make sure they're dead. But Mrs. Voorhees rushes out of the darkness at her with a machete. Narrowly avoiding the machete, Alice knocks out of her hand with the paddle, and the two wrestle by the lake. Alice grabs the machete and decapitates Mrs. Voorhees in one stroke.
That was the best
part.
That
was such a good... I mean, it looked so dumb.
Did you like that there was a blow-by-blow in this?
Yes. I very, very much appreciate it. If you don't know, there's like a shot of Alice doing the swing, and then there's like a slow motion shot of the middle-aged woman going... oh no, and then you just kind of see like a head kind of pop. It's
but
really
the good. Hands are still up.
Yes.
Exhausted, Alice boards and falls asleep inside of canoe, which I don't know, I feel like I kind of made fun of her for that in the moment, but I get it. She's like, I can't be,
yeah, just like I gotta go somewhere,
which floats out on Crystal Lake just as she wakes up and Jason's decomposing body attacks her. And then she awakens inside a hospital with a police officer and medical staff tending to her. When Alice asks about Jason, the officer says there was no sign of any boy. She says, what does she say, Michael?
Then he's still there.
As the lake is shown at peace.
I actually think that's a good part, even if it weren't for establishing that Jason is a character. Like, it's legitimately scary.
Mikey, that was his art. How dare you?
I actually, even besides the fact that it gave us 12 other gems.
Hello there.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
Happy Halloween. Hi. We're talking about Friday the 13th.
Pretend it's Halloween.
But shut up. It's okay. Fucking Halloween.
Sorry.
Have you seen Friday the 13th? What did you think?
I watched it a few days ago.
Really?
That was not a good movie.
No.
Well, no. What did you expect?
Who thought to put it on the new AFI quarter?
Michael!
It was me.
Why? Why did you do that?
Mike, I mean, don't you think it started solid basis for what horror is today?
He's a movie icon.
Jason.
Is it really?
So what'd you think of the film?
Well, it had Kevin Bacon in it, so that was a positive. Despite Michelle constantly saying otherwise, the killer was a woman, which was, that was progressive.
Progressive is positives. A fun way to think about it.
Positives are now over.
What's it bad about the film?
I mean, it wasn't scary.
No.
So there's that. The killer had no, besides being quote unquote insane, she didn't really have a motivation.
I thought she had a great motivation. I would push back on that.
Okay, well, she also was introduced like four fifths the way through the movie.
Yeah, twist.
Twist.
Do you call that a twist?
Do you hate M. Night Shyamalan too?
Those are twists. That was like, okay, I guess we're just not gonna.
It was the trees anything. The whole time. That's an M. Night Shyamalan reference.
Right, right. No, I mean, you kept saying to yourself, thinking it's a trope, like, oh, was it the guy, the truck driver, or, oh, was it the camp leader all run? No, just some random character you haven't seen yet.
Well,
that's not exciting.
I think I disagree. I mean, it's not a good movie, but I actually kind of like the villain.
Yeah, I like the villain, too.
That's interesting. You're both wrong. Entirely.
So, what grade do you give it?
Do I have any more thoughts about it? I don't think I do. I would give it C-.
Cool.
That's such a fair grade. That was Bro Call.
What a great segment. What that, Michael, segment. What grade do you give this film?
I mean, like, C- is so good, but I like it. I mean, I wish I could just give it a new category. Like, it's not a movie. It's like a fun friend time.
I'd give it like a B+ for what it is. I think it delivers exactly on what you're getting. And it really did lay the groundwork for better or worse as to how movies were made in that genre for like a couple decades. Like, that's a pretty big deal.
It's a pretty big deal.
So I'm going to give it a B+.
I'll give it a B. I feel very good about my B. Who are we sponsored by this week?
Mars Candy.
What is
you're going to be eating a lot of. You know, they make like lots of stuff.
Like 100 grand. What's that candy bar?
Well, now I don't know the difference. Yeah, they make M&Ms, but they like make a lot of stuff, don't they? They do.
Well, you can just be sponsored by M&Ms. That's a thing.
Milky Way, Snickers, Twix. Really?
Okay, so they're kind of like the Candy Empire.
Yeah, they're the Candy Empire. That's what I was thinking. But I just I wanted to make sure before I.
This sounds very lucrative, this sort of this
I know,
sponsorship
right?
we got.
Well, we got paid in Snickers bars.
That's my favorite candy. So thank you very much for that sponsorship. And if anyone else wants to recommend those films, please do that on our Facebook page.
And if you want to rate us 5 stars on iTunes,
we'll allow it.
Do it right now.
It's okay. We'll accept it. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of Flareon Films. And cut.